Welcome to Politics Unlocked. Today I'm chatting with Phil Morehouse, political commentator with his YouTube channel, A Different Bias. The episode is split into two sections. First, we talk about general political issues, the role of independent media, politics fatigue, and how to engage people in the political process. Then we talk about the political issues of the day, including Jeremy Corbyn's suspension from the Labour Party, and an edict from the BBC which suggests that BBC personalities are not allowed to express personal political views on social media or even attend political marches. Hope you enjoy the episode, and if you want to skip to certain sections, follow the timestamps in the description. With me now is Phil Morehouse, who speaks daily about political issues on his YouTube channel, A Different Bias. Welcome, Phil.
Hiya.
So, Phil, as we said before our recording, we didn't realise that today would be such an active news day. But before we get to the main issues of the day, I wondered if we could chat a little bit about being a political commentator on YouTube and being in what we might consider an alternative media outlet. So how did you get started in this area and what were your intentions initially?
So originally I got started, I used to play quite a lot of computer games and I started a YouTube channel for that. And a couple of years ago, really now, I had to sort of rein that back a little bit because work was getting a bit much. And but I'd so enjoyed YouTube because it seems to me it's a level of freedom. When I was growing up, you would read books, you'd watch television programs. You were sort of aware that very few people would be able to sort of have a voice through those outlets. YouTube gives you a certain freedom, which doesn't come with an awful lot of responsibilities, it has to be said. I suppose a little bit more since the adpocalypse. You have to be a little bit more careful, but still. And so I thought I'd really like to carry on doing YouTube. And I've always been very interested in politics. And regardless of whether I were doing a channel on it or not, I, you know, discuss politics. I read a lot about political events. So I thought, well, I'll just do what everyone does when they want to get started on YouTube. I'll just vlog because that's the thing. I'll just talk rubbish. And that's initially what I did. My first few videos weren't very regular and they were on random topics. I really didn't know what I was doing. And then towards the end of 2018, Brexit was really blowing up. We were getting to the point where Theresa May had thrashed out her Chequers agreement. We were going to have a withdrawal agreement, but oh no, because there was the right number of MPs and the right of her party weren't happy with it. And the nature of the parliament at the time meant that politics was becoming increasingly bizarre. And so it just seemed natural to just segue into that. And from the 1st of January to 2019, I thought, I'm going to do a video every day. And it sort of grew from there because we are in very, very interesting. It's like there was a former colleague of mine who always used to say, it's a Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. We live in extremely interesting times. And that's sort of how it went.
Well, it's certainly been interesting since, 2016, it's a bit of a cliche to say, was an awakening for a lot of people in terms of either engaging more strongly in politics and political discussion or almost burying their head in the sand out of sheer exhaustion.
Yes. Well, that's ultimately what put the blame to a certain extent on the 2019 general election. There were an awful lot of people that just had Brexit burnout, and it was felt, look, we just want it done. Boris Johnson was promising to get it done. Let's just get it done either way because we don't like all this messing about, kicking the can down the road. I'm not sure how many of them agree with their decision now, but still.
Well, yeah, well, we can come to that really, but it's interesting you should talk about the burnout because one of the things obviously that people on the left and in various camps around the world that are trying to sort of push against increasing authoritarianism, one of the challenges that they have is to engage a broader net, a broader church, to use the common phrase, in politics, because that's the only way to sort of rebalance the numbers. And if you were, I guess, speaking to someone who is of that position where they don't engage and they feel burned out or exhausted, or they've taken on that sort of cliched position of, oh, well, they're all the same, and therefore you know, there's no point in me gauging whatever. Is there anything right now that you could say to them or an issue or an example?
Well, I think 2019, all of a sudden, that didn't seem to be the case. You had a Conservative Party that lurched very far to its right. As a consequence, really, Labour lurched very far to its left. And what that meant was that Labour had abandoned the centre ground, as you might call it. The Liberal Democrats were in a certain amount of disarray. And the Conservatives then found the Brexit Party seriously challenging them on the hard right. So they lurched to the right, really, presumably feeling that they could afford to abandon the centre because no one was fighting on that hill. And they shifted far to the right. So I think you do hear a lot of, you do absolutely all the time. I've been growing up, people going, oh, it doesn't really make any difference which, you know, bunch of clowns I vote in, which I've never really believed myself. I mean, but then, you know, I grew up in a mining village in the 80s. So I don't think many people would have felt that it didn't make any difference in that background. But I think in 2019, I'm not sure how many people would have really, I'm sure some did, but I can't imagine that too many people really felt it didn't make a difference, because they were, both parties had gone to almost to their extremes.
Well, it's a strange that you should mention that example of you growing up in a mining town in the 80s, because that generation of people are, to a certain extent, I don't want to overgeneralize, nor have I counted back exactly the time frame to see if I'm exactly right, but they, you could argue that they're the same people right now who are sort of being taken in by a New York-born Etonian, Brussels-brought-up millionaire who's sort of positioned himself as a champion of the people.
Yes.
And in a very strange way, positioned Labour as the liberal elite.
Yes.
That's quite a big transition to go.
It is. It's spectacular to me when I heard, you know, groups polling people in the north of England who regarded Boris Johnson as down to earth. And now, fair enough, Jeremy Corbyn also comes from a fairly privileged background himself, not quite to the same extent as Boris Johnson, but it seemed surprising to me that people would feel that about Boris Johnson. But that is just the extent on which he has taken his public image very seriously, and he's worked on it. It was known that he worked on it very hard when he was running to become mayor of London. Mm-hmm. You know, he was...
He certainly had a liberalist sort of approach where he was neither here nor there. At least that was my impression at the time, as someone who didn't live here when he was running for mayor of London, I don't think.
Mm. Well, he had a clear plan. I mean, it's probably the only plan he's ever had. You know, he had a clear plan in politics, didn't he? And he actually worked on it, and he got people to mind him effectively and make sure that he presented himself. And I suppose you have to do that in politics. Public image, unfortunately, is... Well, I suppose I say unfortunately, it is... I mean, I've always said that the issue is you need political leaders to have the sort of charisma that convinces millions of people who will never meet you that you are the person to put their trust in. And you know, there have been times where I have had a lot of respect for certain politicians that just didn't have that charisma, and therefore they ultimately failed. I think Ed Miliband, I had a lot of respect for him, but he was never going to inspire those millions of people. He just didn't have it. You know, I wouldn't have it.
Do you think, as well as, and I absolutely agree with you with that charisma where you have to, in a sense, be able to convey an entire personality through a photo of you holding up a fish or, you know, some really contrived situation, but it has to convey your personality to a wide variety of different communities, all of whom will say, yeah, I trust that guy, he seems okay, or that girl, you know, seems okay. In the UK, there seems to be, maybe it's not UK specific, but something that I noticed, where there's an interesting paradox of both wanting someone who's down to earth, but also expecting that the political class are also a particular type of people, or maybe accepting that they're a particular type of people. So nobody is maybe put off by that contradiction of having all of the political class come from a certain set of schools, but also say that they're salt of the earth.
Yeah, it's interesting that, because my partner, who now, I mean, you were talking before about 2016 as a bit of an awakening. It roundabout, not Brexit so much, but Corbynism was hers. So I only met her last year. But she was awakened to politics at that time. She was a Corbyn supporter. I was as well a long time ago. I remember when I was a young lad in the 80s, and he was being interviewed about his style of dress, which I thought was fine, but they were it was really like parlor, because it was like a tweed jacket or something like that, and it wasn't a smart suit, but it was perfectly smart, I thought. And they were questioning whether that was really suitable attire for Parliament, and he defended himself, and I thought, yeah, I like this man. And then when he became Labour leader, he started wearing the suits. And I have to say to my partner, she didn't do that. And she was trying to tell me, but you have to go with the look. And she sort of said about Keir Starmer that he looks the part. And I never saw it myself. But you know, I also, because I didn't think Keir Starmer had that sort of charisma. You know, he's the sort of quiet guy that would be absolutely brilliant lieutenant, but I didn't see him as being the leader of the Labour Party. And yet, you know, there was anecdotal evidence, there was polling evidence suggesting, you know, when people were saying they didn't want Jeremy Corbyn, who would you want? A lot of them were saying Keir Starmer. And I didn't see it myself, but it is evidently there.
Well, his stock certainly rose when he was Brexit Secretary or Brexit Shadow Secretary.
Well, I mean, he's relatively new in Parliament. He only won his seat in 2015, didn't he?
You know, the point you were making around Keir Starmer sort of being seen as a particular, as having a particular style of leadership that people warmed to, one of the ways that we can see that being the case, and I was, you know, with you in the sense that I never thought neither here nor there about it, but we could see the response within the Conservative Party, arguably with Boris Johnson, who, as you mentioned earlier, his carefully crafted image of his ruffled hair and his just slightly dishevelled, sort of, I've just come from doing something interesting that I can't really tell you about, look, has sort of morphed a little bit since Keir Starmer has become leader. I don't know whether you think that that's related or coincidental.
I think Boris Johnson, one of the things he has taken seriously is his public image. I think it's one of the few things he's actually listened to people about, because he understands the importance of it. And, you know, obviously, initially when Keir Starmer became leader, Boris Johnson was still ill. It was Dominic Raab in the hot seat. But as soon as Boris Johnson came back, it was very evident after the first two Prime Minister's questions that Boris Johnson could not carry on the way he was. And so he clearly cultivated a different way of approaching that. So he certainly takes the threat of Keir Starmer seriously. That was obvious from the way he did adapt.
So moving to, I guess, the issues that it seems will never leave us, but I hope they'll be over at some point. Brexit, and then latterly COVID. But if we shift to Brexit for a minute, if you don't mind, we've lived under the cloud of Brexit for years now. And one of the things that I expected to happen, but I'm surprised never has happened in the UK media. Now, notwithstanding the fact that I just might not have found it, so I might not have been looking hard enough, is this comprehensive outline as to what this is really going to mean. So every news discussion I've seen about it breaks it into very small, almost segregated issues like fishing or soybeans or farmers or passports. Never really somebody in the media saying, look, this is, well, apart from a few discussions on certain channels, this is really what's going to happen. These are the sum of all of the points that you're going to have to deal with over time. Is that intentional? Is it cultural? Is it a fear of reprisal?
I suppose it depends where you look. I mean, of the main media, the national media, the place where I actually find the most interesting information is often the Financial Times. Now, there are a few other interesting ones as well, The Economist and so on. But the Financial Times is the one that usually has the breakdown, because ultimately they represent people who need to make money. And for a lot of investors, this is pretty bad news.
Mm-hmm.
You've also, if you look at some of the rest of the media as well, in terms of their general stance on it, the Times, for example, obviously backed the Conservative Party in the election, but they didn't back their Brexit stance. Whereas then you've got sort of more populist newspapers, the Telegraph and the Mail, and particularly the Express and the Sun. And, you know, you sort of get the impression from their point of view. Very much, I suppose, like someone like myself with YouTube, it's about the clicks, isn't it? It's about getting lots of people interested in it. And therefore, you want the world to be really terrible. I mean, I keep feeling really bad. I know that my channel does quite well because politics is really divisive at the moment. And when politics normalizes, it won't. The only difference is I actually wish for the day when not politics normalizes, whereas these newspapers rely on scandal. They rely on fear, effectively, because they want to know about the thing that threatens them. And for too long, because a lot of them, this may be my political bias sneaking in here, but because a lot of them essentially back conservative governments, or at the very least centre-right points of view, but they also know that those points of view are not necessarily in keeping with the British population's priorities.
Mm.
They need, when the government isn't delivering all these wonderful things, they need someone to blame. And politicians and the media alike have been happy to say, well, this is all the fault of this group of European nations that we're part of. We have to follow some rules we wouldn't really like to. And it's just suited them. And quite a lot of these people weren't anti-EU. It just suited them to have someone to blame. And probably even David Cameron himself never imagined that we'd end up leaving the EU.
Well, his response the day after the referendum suggested that he wasn't really counting on it. That is interesting, and I think that sort of summarised my suspicions and what certain sort of commentators have outlined, which is the slow drip feed of anti-EU. I want to say propaganda, but I don't mean it in the extreme sense, but anti-EU messaging for years and years and years, to which a lot of people just didn't understand the cumulative effect that it was having, combined with years of austerity that led to deprivation, that suddenly sort of created this perfect storm of, you know, well, you've been telling us for 30 years that these people are the problem. We're currently in a very difficult situation. How are you going to backtrack on that, essentially? You know, and that sort of messaging, that 30 years of messaging. When I grew up in Ireland, one of the things that was very different, if you want to say, was that the membership of the EU was seen as a point of pride, really, I guess. Starting just as a point of international recognition, in a way, for Ireland. And then acknowledging all of the support that Ireland got, because it was one of the deprived countries, you know, when it joined and then became a sort of success story of Europe. So I remember growing up seeing, you know, supported by the European Union on almost every building or every public venture.
Particularly England, but people point at that. It applies quite a lot to Britain. I think there's two aspects to our character that have sort of, I mean, someone was saying the other day, it's like they were from Poland and they were, you know, talking of the EU, and someone had said to them, well, you would say that you're from the EU. And it's like, well, so were we until recently. But a lot of people never saw, it was always us and the EU. We were never part, they never saw us part of the EU. And I think part of that is two aspects to our character. The thing I always say is a really big part of it is a lot of countries in Europe, if not almost every country in Europe in living memory, has been invaded. And the EU is ultimately a peace project. And so, you know, there's that side of it we didn't really get. For us, it was about trade, not the peace project, because we've not felt threatened in a very, very long time, seriously threatened. And the other side of it, of course, is this notion of British exceptionalism. Like a lot of countries every country, you know, has got away with some stuff in the past. But a lot of countries then get their comeuppance when they go a bit too far. we haven't really had that in Britain yet. We haven't had our comeuppance. And so we haven't had to face up to some of the things we did. You know, when you taught about British history, it's always taught about the glorious aspects of it. And so that sense of British, you know, exceptionalism is still there. So we get to see. Otherwise, how on earth do you persuade a population that we can somehow do better outside of the EU on our own, you know, as opposed to a part of the largest market on earth? And
yeah, that does explain that sort of missing chunk of history that says there is a reason why we were able to be so prosperous as a small, in terms of scale, you know, geographic scale nation. You know, the land that we prospered from and the people we prospered from.
And it must have been the case with a lot of European countries, of course, but those European countries have had their egos pricked. We haven't yet. I mean, we may be just doing it ourselves now.
One of the things that I was thinking around was the around the Brexit issue. It does also keep it at a very abstract level where we don't really have to engage with any of the tangible, practical realities of Brexit, because up until January the 1st, 2021, it's an entirely abstract concept for most people. And I wondered what your thoughts were around what would be the practical issue or thing that would happen that would make people finally realise, okay, this is a thing that I didn't quite understand.
It would have to be something that directly impacts their lives, and it has to be millions of them at once. So it's not a factory closing down, because that affects some people, and sometimes factories close down even in the EU. It can't be looking ahead a few years' time and comparing our economic position compared to other comparable nations who will have also suffered from COVID but bounced back and we didn't. It will ultimately be, what do people need? They need food, they need medicines, and anything that affects that will be not so much a wake-up call for some, like you say, some will still never recant, but it will be the thing that you point to and go, well, that's just happened. So in the, you know, if we, I mean, even with the deal, it has to be borne in mind, of course, we're still going to have, we're going to need customs arrangements in place because we're leaving the customs union. We don't have an awful lot of infrastructure for that. We don't have an awful lot of staff for that. But you know, without a deal, then of course you've got the issue of tariffs, and you know, we either don't charge import tariffs to keep the prices of these things down, but then we have nothing to bargain with in a deal, or you put them up, in which case the prices go up. Either way, you know, if there is a reasonable worst case, as the government like to call it, of serious food shortages, food price increases when we've already got a lot of people below the breadline, and medicine shortages, or whether it's caused by an actual shortage or the price going up, and therefore the NHS cannot afford as much. You know, these are things that directly impact people's quality of life, even ability to live. And that will be the thing, you know, nothing nebulous about the economy or the fact that, you know, we've agreed a trade deal with Japan that's very much in their favour, despite what our government said. No one's going to read the trade deal. We can't even read it right now anyway. It's not been published. It's going to be the thing that affects their life immediately.
That's interesting, because I was thinking around that question and I thought to myself, and exactly as you said, in theory, food and medicine would be the things that would obviously hit people. But I wondered whether they could be snuck under the cloak of COVID, where people might be able to either mistakenly assume that it's due to COVID and other effects of COVID, or whether the government might sort of allow that ambiguity to sort of remain. And I wondered whether that was why they were fighting so hard to retain access to the passport gates, because that might be the first point of contact for a lot of people with the changes because of Brexit, and probably the only thing that they couldn't sweep under the rug.
I mean, the thing with COVID, of course, is we've by the end of the transition period, it will have been a serious problem in this country for 9 or 10 months. So if we have sudden and widespread problems with getting food and medicine in, then it's very difficult to blame that entirely on COVID. the economy, they will, job losses, they will. There's a lot of things they can absolutely blame on the pandemic because it'll all be mixed in. But, you know, if you had no problem in getting food on the 29th of December and then all of a sudden on the 10th of January, you're seeing the empty shelves again. Or it may even be below because it could be, you know, there may be some panic buying this time. We'll have to see.
Yeah, well, certainly if you live in Kent, yes, and you suddenly sort of, yes, feel like you live in some weird Mad Max truck car,
yeah,
park.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of chaos around the borders, if you happen to live anywhere near a port. I mean, I live reasonably close to Hull as well as Immingham. I don't think that'll be affected as badly, but I think Hull will be quite badly affected. Then, there will be things locally that some people will see as well.
Moving on to the news of today, the biggest story in the news at the moment is Jeremy Corbyn's suspension. And with a view to not getting embroiled in the weeds, as it were, although you're welcome to do so if you want to, I thought I would take a safe question, which is really around what it does to Labour's recent momentum, where we saw a very clear uptick in the polls in terms of favourability, both for Keir Starmer and for the party themselves. And obviously government wasn't having the best time.
We were expecting this for some time. It was supposed to be published last month. And I remember thinking, do you know what, just at the time that Labour are really hammering the Conservatives on COVID, we're going to have this hideous distraction. And this morning, I did a video on it, and I was thinking, I was trying to work out why it had been delayed so long. And I know it was due to some redrafting. I was thinking, and I knew Keir Starmer had a draft copy for some time. And I was thinking, right, has he tried to, and I'll never know what the original draft looked like, of course, but has he tried to sort of make it as ambiguous as possible so that he didn't have to suspend Jeremy Corbyn? Because that was the big question. You know, an absolute firestorm will be created if Jeremy Corbyn is suspended from the party. And I listened to his statement and I listened to the press conference, and he was constantly being asked to lay blame on Corbyn, and he didn't do so. And I thought, right, I've just seen him effectively defend Corbyn as much as he can without obviously standing by him. And then my partner said on her, because she's sort of has been involved with her local Labour Party, she's a bit disenchanted now. And she said on the local group, someone saying Corbyn's being suspended. I said, don't be ridiculous. I've just heard Keir Starmer going to great lengths to try and, you know, explain this is a collective failure of leadership. It's not one person named, all the rest of it. Of course, he's not going to suspend him. And then it was true. And I thought, oh my God. And I know, you know, and I know it wasn't to do with the report. It was to do with Corbyn's response to the report, which was, you know, he said he looked forward to the recommendations being, you know, implemented. I mean, some of them were ones that he should have implemented and didn't. He was advised. But ultimately, it was because he said that he didn't agree with all the findings. It's like, well, this isn't a discussion. This is a legal fact. This is like Boris Johnson saying he didn't agree with the Supreme Court last year. You can't just do that. And particularly at the moment, when you've actively got the Conservatives trying to turn the people against important institutions like an independent judiciary, you know, the idea that you will try and label an independent human right, a Labour of all groups, people in Labour trying to label an independent and a UNA rated human rights group as not getting it right, was ridiculous. Now, I don't know whether he was right to be suspended because it's such a politically hot potato. And I do not know what we talk about polling. Obviously, we'll have to wait and see what the public opinion polls are. I strongly suspect that this suspension will not do Starmer any harm at all, because in the public, Jeremy Corbyn was deeply unpopular. It also, whether it's sensible leadership is another matter, but it is clearly strong leadership. This does not come without massive risk for Starmer and Labour. It would have been the less risky thing to have just picked on the fact that he said that he fully supports putting all these recommendations in place.
Yeah, and I agree with your point that you know, without making a judgment on the rights or wrongs of you know, someone's opinion, let's say Jeremy Corbyn's opinion as to whether something was exaggerated or not, in terms of a political move, it really wasn't the smartest thing to mention it. He could probably think that, and maybe a lot of people would agree with him in terms of media reporting. And again, I don't know. Well, I say I don't know. I've tried a lot to try to dig into the details of the various allegations and issues, but I don't feel like I've come to a clear understanding enough to even summarize them or make a clear judgment on it. So I'm only sort of commenting or opining on his response, whether it was a smart thing to respond in that way. I think, as you said,
I mean, he could take his statement and you could literally just chop out the odd sentence and it would have been fine. Because he said the right things, it's just that he mixed it in with the wrong things as well. I mean, the issue about the media, now what is true? Obviously, a lot of the media were no fans of Jeremy Corbyn, right-wing media, they're not going to be fans of any Labour leader. They reported on it in a way that they wouldn't have done if it was a Conservative thing, but that's not the same as blowing it out of proportion. They reported on it. They wouldn't have reported on it if this was Boris Johnson. That is the extent of political bias in the media. They didn't make up things as such. You know, the way I saw it, I mean, I have this very weird position because I am on the left. Policy-wise, I would agree with an awful lot that Jeremy Corbyn wanted to achieve. However, there are an awful lot of anti-Semites on the left of politics, and I've come across them before. And the problem is that, you know, they live in their little echo chambers. Nowadays, it's Facebook groups, it's social media, but it used to be little discussions in pubs. Okay. It was always there, you know, and because they mistrust, and I think what it is, it's because, like, when you look at, you know, they don't like centrists or centre-left people. And I think the way it is, if you imagine this political spectrum as a two-dimensional line, you just see everyone to the right of you, and you cannot distinguish between someone who's moderate, centre-left, centre-right, far-right, because they're all to the right of you. And there's a very deep sense of mistrust amongst the left of Labour, which I've never really got on with myself. And it has then bred this idea of this false loyalty, really, this togetherness, that if you are not a supporter of someone who's part of that, it's almost like a hive mind. And if you're not going to be part of it, then you are the enemy. You are a fifth columnist, you are a traitor, you're all of these things.
And that phrasing and the terminology is quite prevalent when you sort of see the responses and the discussions, even in public forums. So I wouldn't have been aware of that history that you just talked about those sort of pub discussions. And so this is where someone like me, you know, who's been in the UK for 10 years and sees someone who emerges and says, oh, this person policy wise seems really, you know, along the lines of social justice and so on and so forth. Someone I can get on with, and then you hear all of these other details and you think, wow, I don't see that. But of course, there's a difference between not seeing it and denying that it exists because you haven't seen it. And I don't think that's where I wouldn't necessarily venture. And I think particularly, again, as you said, when a report comes out that suggests that something has happened and action needs to be taken, I think the only thing to do is to show some humility and some contrition and say we need to do it, because I think in practical terms what I think of as someone who is on the left and wants those policies enacted, all this does is serve to
cement, I mean, the that way I see it is division. I know that my politics is not shared by the majority of people are going to be clustered around the centre-ish, some on the left, some on the right. I would like to think more on the left, but still it's clustered over there. So I understand that to win power, I can't have a Labour leadership that will promise to deliver all the policies I would want. But I will take 10, if I had 20 policies, I will take someone who will promise to back 10 of them and 10 others that are not horrendous over a government that will put none of them in place and put 20 horrendous ones in place. You know, it's politics, unfortunately, particularly when it's first past the post. Now, if we could all get behind, for example, progressive politics for the next election and get proportional representation in place, Labour in that situation would absolutely split. It would split in two, and that would be it, and everyone would be reasonably happy. And no.
The tribes would all split off,
but they can still get MPs. The only reason they stay together, it's a marriage of convenience, really, a large party like the Conservatives and like Labour, because in the first past the post, it's the only way to win power. But then you just have all these battles for supremacy, which is disappointing because no one's allowed to compromise. You know, if you even, I mean, I'm a Blairite just because I said, well, Tony Blair did some things I agreed with. Oh, you're a Blairite then. Okay, fine. And you can't, you know, if you try and say you're a socialist, well, you can't be a socialist because you said something mean about Jeremy and you said something nice about Tony. What's going on? And it's all, you know, I mean, the politics of personality, I suppose, comes into it to a certain extent as well. But this tribalism is always more damaging for Labour, it seems, than the Conservatives. I mean, the Conservatives have their little battles, but they then tend to fall in line.
Well, one could argue, rightly or wrongly, that the reason behind that is that the left is battling over principle, and the right is power.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So everything else falls behind that.
Mm.
A last point. Today we've seen that BBC staff have been told, to quote, to avoid virtue signalling on social media platforms, even if it's their own personal account, even going so far as not being allowed to attend marches that are seen to be political. This sort of comes full circle to what we talked about earlier on about why somebody might have an independent media channel.
Ultimately, of course, anything that is, where the government have any form of control over funding or the structure of it can never be truly independent. This is the problem. Now, you know, I mean, an awful lot of people, I mean, the BBC is now, and, you know, the thing is, the overall BBC organisation is marvellous. It's the political news team, effectively, that is letting the whole side down. And you hear a lot of people saying that we should not pay the licence fee and we should abolish the BBC as if it's going to be replaced by something better. It's not going to be replaced by a left-wing news channel. It will be replaced by, you know, well, they're already, you know, our plans well advanced for a Fox News-style channel in this country. I think there's a couple as
GB
well.
GB News, isn't it?
That is one of them. I think that's this January, isn't it? But I mean, ultimately, there's certain organisations that they need funding, and of course, the government has to stump up, you know, the funding for those. But they really shouldn't. Government should not have any sort of sway over them. You know, and the BBC is one of them. The police would be another. And unfortunately, the fact that they are and that they can make appointments and that they can threaten the licence fee is where we are now, because we have, you know, a Conservative Party in the past had a certain amount of respect. Obviously, any government, it will want to encourage the media to provide their spin on things. And it's up to the media really to resist that. But where we're going now is we've got a government that effectively seem to have no boundaries. And they don't mind threatening things. They don't mind. And they are, it's almost like you believe the threats with them as well. They are that insane, is the impression you get.
Well, you made a video recently which started with the headline, there's a nastiness to the Conservative Party now that wasn't present. And not to get you to sort of regurgitate the points that were there, but if someone was to say, for example, for argument's sake, well, you know, the party since 2010 has been promoting austerity, and there's the bedroom tax and universal credit and so on and so forth, and the UN suggested they were increasing or promoting or causing poverty in untold numbers. Is it that they're nastier now, or is it that they're just worse at hiding it?
It's like, I always felt, some time ago, the previous Conservative government before Tony Blair, John Major's government, Thatcher's before them, that they genuinely believed in what they were doing, and I thought they were wrong. Whereas now, I mean, with David Cameron, for example, again, I don't think he did believe that what he was doing was in people's interest, but he would never have turned round and vilified people who do good, you know, use it as a term of offence, people who do good, mm-hmm. or to attack judges. So I think now, I think it is nastier now, because whereas it used to maybe do things that were harmful to people, but it would champion noble pursuits, even though it never engaged them in them themselves. Whereas now they actively pour scorn on them. You know, that they are undermining the rule of law in a way that didn't happen before. And although David Cameron would not just misuse stats, a lot of people misuse stats, but just lie about them. The Office for National Statistics constantly pulled him up. But he had boundaries that just don't seem to be present with the current crop. And this is not just Boris Johnson. This is also Priti Patel, of course, and, you know, and Jacob Rees-Mogg. I mean, Jacob Rees-Mogg and Priti Patel, they both had to keep them fairly quiet during the general election campaign because they're extreme even for conservatives. Whereas now they seem to be able to do and say what they will.
So you think that the shackles have come off, and I think one of the things then maybe that links to what my thoughts around their current way of communicating is that they used to sort of subtly invoke certain, what you might, you know, spin used to be, and I say used to as if the world has changed entirely, but it does feel a little bit like that. You know, they would say conservatives are spinning this story a particular way, but we seem to have moved a little bit from spin to complete newspeak now, where we describe things that are in front of us as if they're not there, as if they're entirely different. So, you know, we all have an Australian-style deal with the European Union. It's just really sort of cementing that's the way we do things now.
I mean, the fact that they already have a large part of the media that will comply with them anyway, so it wasn't a big step for them to simply, you know, boycott any programme that will give their ministers a tough time. Now, if it was just the case that half the media would back for them and half would not, it would be more difficult for them to do that. But given that there are now very few that would ask them tough questions, even if threatened, it's very easy for them to just boycott Channel 4 News, for example, or Newsnight or The Guardian or The Mirror, whatever they like, because it's a relatively small part of the media now, the news media. So, and you know, my point would be that it's worked for them. They're not going to change until this behavior costs them, you know, until it costs them. And it, realistically, it probably can't cost them until 2024 at the very least. Then why would they change it? It's worked. We've got people in power that have no shame over using these things. If Boris Johnson is ousted and Dominic Cummings is ousted and we get a new leader, I've still no doubt that whether they are as extreme, I don't know, but I've still no doubt that they will see that it has worked. Why shouldn't they carry it on? Until it actually proves to be an electoral liability, they will do.
Well, there's nothing like ending on an optimistic note.
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Unless you have a solution for me.
I'm afraid I don't. For 4 years.
Well, that's it for this episode of Politics Unlocked. Thanks for joining me and Phil. And I hope you'll join us next time for some more political discussion.